Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk, no nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
January 21st, 2015, the day after President Obama delivered a feisty, strong State of the Union address to a Republican-controlled Congress. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. This show will entertain you, educate you, and include you in the conversation about today's hot legal issues. This is an interactive show. We want to hear from you. Email the show at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Please like our Facebook page at facebook.com/talkinlaw. You can listen to all our prior episodes on Blog Talk Radio, on iTunes, or on player.fm. Last week's show was selected by Blog Talk Radio as today's best in the legal category. It was a very interesting discussion featuring former NYPD Captain Joseph Kincannon. We discussed the current hostilities and tension between Mayor Bill de Blasio and the rank and file of the NYPD. Please check out that show. Check it out on iTunes. Go to Blog Talk Radio. You'll enjoy it. This show today is going to be fantastic. We're very fortunate to have with us former Congressman Bob Ney, N-E-Y. Former Congressman Ney served in Congress from 1995 to 2006 as a Republican from Ohio's 18th District. He is the former chairman of the House Administration Committee. In 2007, Ney pleaded guilty to federal corruption charges arising out of the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. He was sentenced to 30 months in prison. He served 17 months in prison at the Federal Correctional Institution in Morgantown, West Virginia. Since his release from prison, he has picked himself up. He has worked for the Talk Radio News Service and has written a book entitled Sideswiped: Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill. Congressman Bob Ney, are you with me?
Yes, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm on radio today across the U.S. talking about the State of the Union, of course.
Well, I want to hear your thoughts. Before we get into your background, which is fascinating, what do you think about the president's address last night? I thought, regardless of the politics, I thought he came across pretty strong.
Oh, he did. You know, this is the first address I can remember, and I've sat through them personally, but I can remember where the whole address was put out over the weekend. I mean, that's kind of risky, but they did it. And I thought that the president, I'm not going to say that it was his way or the highway, but I thought he very, very clearly was saying, look, I got the upper hand. You know, you might control the chamber, the Republicans. I've got the upper hand. That's what I thought the message was. And it was delivered well. It was delivered well.
I thought he did a very good job at basically, like you said, controlling the conversation, saying, yes, you control the Congress. However, I'm controlling the conversation, and here are my ideas, and basically challenging the Republicans to come up with better ideas.
In fact, a lot of my friends that have been supporters of the president told me this morning, we emailed a lot, and they said, you know, they kind of wish he'd have done this a few years back, a little bit more forceful. But I just thought he was setting the agenda and the tone and throwing some ideas out there. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, and I saw some talking heads on television last night say perhaps if he did this before the last congressional election, maybe it would not have been such a disaster for Democrats. But we are going to talk more about the State of the Union when we get to our question of the day later in the program. But first, I want to go way back with you so people can get an idea of who you are, where you came from. Tell us what you were doing before you first ran for Congress all those years ago.
Sure. I had moved to Iran, which is the country of topic right now, 1978. I was a teacher, and I taught Iranians. The revolution happened. I came to the United States, and I challenged my former congressman, very powerful guy, Wayne Hayes, in 1980. The district was 3% Republican. People laughed, and I beat him. He was a state rep, former congressman. Then I became a state senator. I actually lost my reelection for state rep by 126 votes, then went in the Senate a year later and became chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, very good committee. Was going to run for governor, and Newt Gingrich, I don't know, I say hypnotized me, drugged me, I'm not sure, and I turned around and ran for a 13% Republican index seat in eastern Ohio in 1994. So I had been a state senator before I ran for Congress, state rep and state senator, teacher by degree.
How did you wind up in Iran?
Well, that's kind of interesting. My sister, who's from Wheeling, West Virginia, where I'm actually at today, took in a child from Iran. He was 12 years old. He didn't speak English. I was younger, I learned Farsi. And then up in Ohio State, we had probably 2,000 Iranian students in the day. You know how that was. There were 38,000 in the U.S. I had some Iranian roommates. I learned Farsi, and so I could speak Farsi, and I went to Iran because I couldn't get a teaching job out of college, and they said, hey, you can teach over there. Sure enough, great job, wrong year to go, 1978.
Well, you got out before the hostages were taken, I take it.
Yeah, I stayed till July of 78, and our school was under siege, and things were really bad, and they were, declaring martial law. You couldn't move around the city, so I left. I stayed about 7 months, then I left and came back to the U.S.
And why did you make the decision to run for Congress? What drove you to do that?
Well, I was so happy in the state Senate, I can't tell you. I had an unbelievable position. I was on the controlling board. I was on the board that looked at all rules of the state, and I chaired the budget committee. You know, it was the purse strings. And I was so happy I was going to run for governor. And then the chairman of the Republican Party said, listen, you need to meet with Newt Gingrich. And I said, why? I'm not running for Congress. I've already announced it. He said, well, they can, they got this contract thing, and he was going on and on. I said, listen, they're not going to take control. I'm not going to sit around twiddling my thumbs in Washington. I don't even like D.C. I'm not going to do it. And I was besieged by so many members of Congress coming to my office in Ohio and saying, you need to run. It's a good pension. You need to run. You'll be a congressman. You need to run. All the wrong reasons. I went out to meet with Newt Gingrich simply to tell him no. And I outline this in my book, Sideswipe, just to tell him no as a favor to the chair of the Republican Party of Ohio. I got in there, and what was supposed to be a 10-minute meeting, I'm sitting there listening to Newt Gingrich, and he told me, why I needed to run, which was the window of opportunity in the remaining part of this century to be able to change things for our future. I mean, he didn't mention prestige, pensions, or money. And I looked at him and I said, okay, I'll run. In that quick of a second, I decided to run.
So did you become a true believer in the 1995 contract with America, which Newt Gingrich led?
Now, that's a great question, actually, that nobody's ever focused with me. I never ran on the contract with America. Never ran on it. They told us we had to run on it, and I simply didn't. I said, nope, I've been a state senator down here. I'm going to run on what I like to run on. Now, I supported it because I thought it was a good game plan, but no, I never ran on it. Isn't that interesting? I just, they never knew it. They sent all this material. I'm like, okay, fine.
What was your apprehension about signing on to the contract with America? Why did you run a little bit away from that?
Well, the district was, I believe, 13 to 16% Republican. There hadn't been a Republican congressman for 55 years. It's down from Youngstown, Ohio, Steubenville, Ohio, across from Wheeling, West Virginia. Extremely, at that time, union-controlled, but very conservative Democrats. And I just didn't want to run on a, quote, here's the Republican platform, and I'm going to be a lemming. You know, they always knew I was independent thinking. And so I just ran on, here I am. This is a job I did in Ohio. I can do it. I can go to D.C., and I'll be, a bit of a thorn in the side of everybody, but I'll be level with you. So that, I just decided not to become part of the national agenda, you know. But I did support
your
contract when I got
there. You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I am speaking with former Congressman Bob Ney. And, Congressman, I want to get to the most notorious character that you dealt with during your time in Congress, as far as I know. So tell us, who is Jack Abramoff?
Well, you know, Jack Abramoff was the uber, super grand lobbyist at that time of all time. And he wanted to be a filmmaker. He was extremely close to Karl Rove and George Bush. And when Bush won, that was the end of it. You wanted to be anybody in town. You wanted to achieve something. You know, you curried the favor of Jack Abramoff. He was the super Republican lobbyist. Also, a lot of ties into the AIPAC community, because AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, tended to be a little bit more pro-Democrat side, and Jack had some connections and was trying to change that. But, you know, I came from a district where, you know, I was conservative on my voting on a lot of ways, and the people down there, you know, the Democrats are conservative. They're not extreme liberals at all. And I received wonderful support from people. As I rose up the ladder, because I didn't need Jack Abramoff to win an election. The people were very good to me from all walks of life in the 18th District. But I didn't need Jack Abramoff for that. But I wanted to ascend, frankly, and we had a kitchen cabinet to the position of Speaker, and I had a thorn in my side because I was a very pro-labor Republican, conservative on budgets and conservative on social issues. But Tom DeLay and I had a lot. He was the powerful whip, had a lot of disagreements, and so we kind of needed to neutralize DeLay to not stop me from my goals to achieve more. You know, you achieve more, you do for more for your district, was my belief. I always have believed in that, not just to achieve power. And so somebody said, we need Jack Abramoff. He is so close to Tom DeLay. That's how it all began.
And what were the circumstances under which you first met Jack Abramoff?
I met Jack Abramoff. I had a staffer of mine who knew Jack, and I knew who Jack was, but I never actually had a formal meeting with him. A lot of people in the myth of this scandal think that, you know, I've been hanging around with Jack Abramoff for 30 years because we were both in College Republicans, but that wasn't the case. And my staffer said, you need to meet Jack. He's a really good guy. And I'm not blaming the staffer. And I said, yeah, I heard of him. I wanted to meet him. So I went and met Jack Abramoff. I can't remember exactly where we met. Might have been either in my office or he opened this restaurant, Signatures, downtown, which became our watering hole.
Congressman, and that brings us, you referred to the Jack Abramoff scandal. For our listeners who aren't as familiar with the situation, can you just sort of give a summary, sort of the cliff notes about what was the Jack Abramoff scandal?
Well, to defend Jack, he didn't do anything, and I'll get to the meat of it, but he didn't do anything different than any other lobbyist did. He represented his clients. He had a lot of Indian tribes, Native American tribes, that he was representing. And I was on the committee that had oversight over the Bureau of Indian Affairs when it came to housing issues, and it was on the Financial Services Committee. So Jack had a lot of interest in that, but he got a lot of money for Indian tribes, and he charged them a lot of money. I think it was upwards of $83 million some dollars. But it ended up, Jack Abramoff's downfall became the fact that he got involved with a guy named Adam Kadan that ran a national mattress, very successful mattress chain. They knew each other from College Republican days. They wanted to buy a boat in Miami called Sun Cruise, and it was owned by a guy that was an immigrant from Greece named Gus Boulos. I did a couple of floor resolutions, didn't read them, but I entered them into the record because the assistant attorney general or somebody in Florida had said that Bulis was bad in the gaming industry, and I had supported gaming. And Abramoff asked us to do that, and I put him into the record. Well, lo and behold, Gus Bulis was gunned down execution style in Miami as Jack Abramoff was having trouble with him. Now, Jack didn't kill him, but, you know, at that time, everybody said, wow, you know, who killed Gus Bulis? And that caused a lot of stir, and they found out that Abramoff had falsified some documents, and the fact that I had supported Jack against Gus Bulis, it became a problem for me. Then the bottom line was that Jack had also ran afoul of John McCain and was drug in by John McCain investigating the fact that Jack Abramoff bilked the Indian tribes. And I had went to Scotland with Jack, as Tom DeLay had, and some others on trips. And Jack had taken Tom DeLay to the Mariana Islands. I didn't go there. But I went on this golf trip to Scotland, which was underreported of to its costs. And also, it was unclear to us. I had no idea. I thought a nonprofit group paid for it, and here we find out Jack bilked the Native Indian American tribes for the trip. That caused severe heartburn. One thing led to another. McCain went after Abramoff out of some hatred of Abramoff, because Abramoff actually helped cost him the Bush. I know this is a long story, and it's actually in a movie called Casino Jack with Kevin Spacey, but it ended up Jack Abramoff cost John McCain the presidency, and McCain had his day with Abramoff, and my name got thrown out there, the only name during that hearing, and the rest is history. I did a plea with the Justice Department.
And tell us about the guilty plea. What criminal activity did you admit to?
I pled guilty to two things. Falsification of a federal document, which is interesting because it was a congressional document, actually. It was the Scotland trip, which the staff, I should have questioned this. The staff said the trip was $3,700 and we were going for certain purposes, and those purposes actually didn't come about. There were meetings we said we were going to do, which never came about during the trip. It was a very weird trip. And so I pled to falsification of a federal document because the trip was more than $3,700. The other plea is now found unconstitutional. It doesn't exist anymore. It was called honest services fraud, and I know you're an attorney. You would know this. Honest services fraud, an old 1972 law, and the basic thrust of it, if they can't get you for bribery, they got you for honest services fraud. That's pretty well accepted. And the Supreme Court in 2010 on a 6-0 decision said it was an overreaching law, and they found it unconstitutional. But I pled guilty to that. That basic thrust of the law is that I didn't give the most honest services, you know, to my constituents that I should have, and we had accepted.
Is there retroactivity for that 2010 Supreme Court decision concerning honest services fraud? Were you able to get any relief?
Well, actually, an attorney who's a Democrat has been hounding me because he says that because it was found unconstitutional, I can go through the Justice Department, and he said they must expunge it. I'll just be honest with you, I don't care. I mean, what's done is done. I'm just not going, you know, not really anxious to go down that path. It happened, and I was guilty to some things. In my book, I outline where some people seized my idiocy and used it for their own purposes, you know, which including John Boehner and the White House. But I did some wrong things. But the thrust of it was that, you know, we did favors, a stream of favors, writing letters for Jack, et cetera, which other members wrote too, but we did it because the government says that, which is truthful, that we accepted meals and alcohol from Jack at his restaurant, my staff and I. And that's true.
Now, you wrote a book, Sideswipe, Lessons Learned, Courtesy of the Hitmen of mm-hmm. Capitol Hill. What's the thrust of the book? What's the premise?
Well, the premise of that book is a couple, and there's a couple important reasons I wrote that book. In fact, I have a few pages on why I wrote that book. Number one, I wanted to tell, you know, I had went on 60 Minutes, and I went over to India, and I heard Jack a week later on 60 Minutes, Jack Abramoff, and I thought, wow, he's kind of recreating history. You know, what we did wasn't that bad, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, he's recreating history. So I wanted to write my version of what I thought happened. And And I did. And in my book, I admit what I did wrong. I clearly admit the good, the bad, the ugly, the thorny part of life, and I admit it all. But I also have a chapter called Cry Me a River, which is about Speaker Boehner. I'm pretty candid about him, in fact, very candid, and his involvement. And I also have about prison rehabilitation and also alcohol and drug addiction. But the thrust of the book is to say, you know, this is what I did, this is what I did wrong, but here are the little side twists to this, which were pretty good, including getting an appointment for Alice Fisher, using me to get her appointment by the Bush administration because she was having trouble. She was close to Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff's legal, you know, to the legal defense team, and was being criticized. Once I went away, it made her appointment easier, and I think Boehner, the speaker, had a hand in that. So that's part of it. But it's not all to say woe is me or anything. I lay out clearly what I did. The other part of the book, though, is to, and I end it this way, everything Jack Abramoff and I did, every single thing, every dinner where I violated the law, everything I did wrong has now been codified into law by the Congress. If you're a congressman, I can take you to Las Vegas, including your family and your staff. We can have a $5,000 dinner that night with the best wines on earth. I can raise you $125,000. It's perfectly legal. So they did what Jack and I did. They took it and made it legal. They codified it into law. And I talk
Congressman,
about that again.
Congressman, where can people get your book? Is it available on Amazon, other places?
Yes, Amazon. Amazon has, if you type in Sideswiped Bob Ney, they'll see the book there.
Excellent.
It's also now, just been printed into Arabic, by the way, so in the Mideast.
Very good. So let's talk about you're a congressman. You get caught up in this whole Jack Abramoff trips to Scotland, dining at his restaurant, and you wind up taking a plea, and then you spend 17 months in a federal prison in West Virginia. Tell us, what was it like going from being a congressman to going to being an inmate?
Well, it was bizarre. I had never spent a day in my life in any jail, period. And, you know, one minute I'm chairman of House Administration, I have offices in the Capitol and five offices in Ohio, and the next minute, you know, you're in khakis and somebody's going to tell you when you're going to eat and you're walking down a hallway in a prison. But the thing that woke me up the first day was when a prisoner turned to me, and I talk about this in the book, and he looked at me and said, "Are you the congressman?" I said, "Well, I used to be." And he said, "You put me in here." He said, "You passed a drug law. You put me in here." And I thought, okay, we have to refocus my projections about what I want to do when I get out of prison. This is a one-day-at-a-time deal. So I really utilized a lot of my interactions with constituents and the political system over the years in the sense of, in constituents, you know, I tutored some guys in, for their GED program. I was in a drug rehab program. I helped some people out. So I tried to give back. Look, you know, I was educated. I had privilege. And so I tried to give back to a lot of the inmates, you know, some things they haven't had opportunity with to have knowledge of. And I would talk to some of the classes in there and interacted with people. I actually became better friends, I've got to tell you, with the people for drug convictions than I did the white-collar guys. The white-collar guys, there were some good ones, but they tended, 25% of the prison was white-collar crime. They tended to be kind of whiny. You know, I lost my house in Vail or blah, blah, blah. The drug guys were like really pretty for real street people. And I learned a lot from them because a lot of these guys in prison, and there's women too, but I was in a men's facility. Look, they're not the big-time drug dealers where, you know, the government says, "We just caught the big guy." These are drug addicts, and they really need to get a rehab program going in prison for a lot of these people. They really do.
So what is different now about the relationship between members of Congress and lobbyists since you pleaded guilty, if anything?
I think people are more cautious, but, you know, and they can't just go get a dinner as easy, but, you know, they're taking trips, they're taking hunting trips. They're having expensive dinners. As long as it's done under the guise of a fundraiser, it's cool. They can do, I mean, they can pale any dinner that Jack ever bought me, Jack Abramoff. They can pale that. It's all under the fundraising guise. So I don't personally think much has changed. And if you had Jack and I together, I think we'd have a lot of agreement in the sense of, you know, not much has changed. If somebody ever wanted to pursue these people, I don't know if they could put them in prison because it's all done under the fundraising guise, you know.
Do you have any recommendations or thoughts about how we can reduce the influence of money in politics?
Yes. You know, tomorrow morning, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, and then, of course, you'd need McConnell and Reid, could all have lunch and within 10 minutes agree that the parties aren't taking the huge money. Members can take money. They could actually make not a fake John McCain campaign finance bill. That was a joke years ago. That empowered these super PACs, actually. But they could, you know, actually limit the amount of huge money coming into the party. Individual members, I don't worry about their contributions as much as, you know, the parties get huge money. And I've been in rooms where they say, hey, you know what, now come on, pharmaceutical guys don't like this, come on. I mean, that's been talked by both parties in that direction. So the leaders could limit that. They could immediately say, the only trip you can take, the only trip is paid by the government. No more, you know, of the overseas trips paid for by special groups and nonprofits and foreign governments. Just stop it. They could do that in 10 seconds, those leaders. They could. That would be a start.
Congressman, we're almost out of time, but before I leave you, give me an idea of what candidates you would like to see run for president to succeed President Obama.
Well, I believe you're going to have Elizabeth Warren's going to make Hillary Clinton make some statements, but you're going to have Hillary Clinton. So, and I think for the Democratic side, I think that's great. For the Republican side, they've got to take a deep breath. If they do Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush, I think it's over with. Hillary Clinton is the president. I'd like to see, you know, some fresh faces. Now, I'm going to throw out a couple of names. People are going to go, you got to be kidding. I know Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, gave a bad presentation at his, you know, slap at the State of the Union a couple of years ago. But I think a Bobby Jindal, I think a Rand Paul would make a fascinating race, actually. But if they go to, you know, Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, Jeb Bush, and Mitt Romney, it's done. I mean, I'd technically love to see a female candidate in the Republican Party go head-on-head, like Senator Kelly Ayotte or someone, head-on-head with Hillary Clinton. I think it would be a healthy race.
Congressman, can you give me a yes or no? Will you ever seek elected office again?
I love this question. I'm in the Ohio Valley today. I'm asked it constantly. I'm not going to run at this point in time. How's that?
A true politician. Former Congressman Bob Ney, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Oh, yes, sir. I love your show. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Take care now. Now, the question of the day. What did President Obama not say in last night's State of the Union? And now we will go to Beth Karras before we get the answer to the question of the day.
Beth, what can I do?
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth. How are you doing?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. I saw a funny joke about the Jody Arias case yesterday online somewhere. I think the joke was Jody Arias is going to be the first defendant ever to be sentenced to life on trial for the rest of her life.
That is funny. Life on trial. That is true.
Right. I mean, that's basically her sentence.
Yeah, really. She has been in the Maricopa County Jail, Estrella Jail it's called, since the summer of 2008. And her first trial was 5 months long, penalty phase, only a few days. There was a deadlock there. That's why we're back. This penalty phase is going to be as long as the guilt phase. And there are a lot of stops and starts in the trial, but they've only worked 1 4-day week in 11. This is the 12th week, and it's not a 4-day week. So it just doesn't meet that often.
What happened yesterday, Beth?
Yesterday, the defense continued with the psychologist who had been on the stand until late last year. He was unavailable the first few weeks of January. And he's, you know, the rules are different in a penalty phase, the rules of evidence. So he's been testifying to a lot of hearsay, which is permissible in this mitigation phase. And he was talking about text messages between the victim, Travis Alexander, and other women that the records show. I mean, it's in black and white. These are text messages from the phone company. He was having simultaneous sexual conversations with a number of women at the same time that he was having this secret sexual relationship with Jodi Arias. And it appears that he was sleeping around with other women. Look, the guy was single. Jodi Arias wasn't his girlfriend anymore, but she wanted him for herself, and that is presumably why she killed him. If I can't have you, nobody can. Although she says, and the jury rejected at the first trial, that he came at her and she was defending herself. There seemed to be far too much evidence of premeditation. In any event, the guy was a player, and the defense is introducing this to show, I guess, that he didn't treat her right, the defendant. He didn't treat other women well, necessarily, and that somehow it mitigates, you know, you should understand. You know, she killed him. He was abusive to her, allegedly, and have a little mercy.
Were there any indications in those text messages between Travis Alexander and these other women that these other relationships involved abuse?
No, nothing like that. Unlike the exchanges he had with Jodi Arias, we saw where he called her all kinds of names and I never want to see you again. He was absolutely, I mean, psychologically abusive, one could argue, in the text messages, at least a fight they had a week before she killed him, which many believe precipitated her, you know, planning it and driving from, like, the California-Oregon border to Mesa, Arizona to kill him. So we didn't see any of that. We just saw flirtation with other women.
So where do you think the defense is going with these text messages? They're going to establish Travis Alexander was a player. Maybe he wasn't a great Mormon. Maybe he wasn't the most moral guy. I could see the juror saying, so what? How is that evidence of mitigation?
Well, the psychologist said, look, I needed to see the big picture of how he related to other women in order to understand his relationship with Jodi Arias. Obviously, he's not around to talk to. I didn't talk to these other women. I reviewed documentation, and there was a lot of it. There were two huge binders full of these text messages. We only saw a smattering of a couple. He had put up his wheel, sort of domestic violence, of abuse, and sort of manipulation and control was in the middle, and then, you know, there's just various types. I guess it's kind of a spectrum of abuse. And we've heard this from two experts the defense has called, the spectrum of abuse, and they can start with sort of name-calling and, you know, just controlling, and they go up to the ultimate of, you know, beating somebody up and physical abuse. And he said that he did see a pattern of manipulation and control in these text messages. Because he would tease the women and kind of maybe, you know, he'd try to get them to come over to his house, and he was just manipulative. Now, listen, probably a lot of women in that courtroom were saying, oh, man, I can relate to this. I've had boyfriends who treated me like that or did that. I mean, that's kind of the nature of relationships, you know, you manipulate a little bit, you get somebody to come over or not. So I don't know how this is flying with the jury, but he did see a pattern, he says, of manipulation and control in these text messages, along with the flirtation. It was part of the flirtation.
Will they be court again today?
They're going to be court this afternoon only. It's a half day. I suspect one of the lawyers has something that's a problem with scheduling, not the jury. So because it was announced to the jury that it's a half day, but it will go a little bit longer. And then there's court again tomorrow. The defense is close to wrapping up, finally, their mitigation evidence, unless Jodi Arias is going to take the stand. That's the wild card. She took the stand for two half days in secret. We've seen that test. We've seen the transcripts now. We don't know if she's going to get back up in open court and finish her testimony. If she does, this case is, you know, has got several more weeks of the defense case. If she doesn't, the state will begin its rebuttal evidence next week, which would be great news.
Before we get to that, I assume that as a matter of procedure, if Jodi Arias does not retake the witness stand, that her direct testimony will be stricken, since the prosecution never had a chance to cross-examine her.
Well, good question. I assume the same thing. But I spoke with one of the top capital defense attorneys here in Maricopa County in Phoenix, who has a great relationship with the county attorney's office. That's what the DAs are called, county attorneys. And she said, this is a case of first impression. And the judge does not have to strike it.
Interesting.
If she does not have to, because it's a penalty phase. It can go unchallenged, not cross-examined. If this was a guilt phase, yes, indeed, it would have to be stricken because it would need to be cross-examined. In fact, I'll tell you real fast, there are 14 witnesses the defense wants to call who are refusing to testify because of the cyberbullying that witnesses in the first trial felt as a result of, one could argue, HLN's coverage. Okay. They're not testifying. The defense has submitted affidavits now of what they would say if they testified. And Juan Martinez, the prosecutor, even concedes, look, that's a way around this problem. I can't cross-examine them. I can't challenge them. And it's perfectly acceptable. So that's what happened.
It seems to me there's a big risk here for developing a bad precedent. And they say tough cases make bad law. If the judge says the Jodi Arias direct testimony can stand without cross-examination, what you're going to have, in my opinion, going forward, is you're going to have penalty phase defendants testifying, and then before cross, they're just going to say, I'm not going to do it. And you're going to have a precedent that says it's okay. And then the prosecution's going to be at a big disadvantage. I really don't see how that's going to work.
Well, you raise a good point, and I'm sure that Juan Martinez – well, actually, I know that Juan Martinez has moved to strike the testimony because when we were given the transcripts of Jodi Arias' secret testimony, the sidebars were included, and he does discuss striking the testimony. The judge didn't rule because obviously it's still an open issue whether or not she's going to finish her testimony. So, I mean, the judge may very well strike it, but all I know is what I was told is that she does not have to. I would agree with you that it would set this precedent where defendants in penalty phases will say, I'm going to get up and give a direct only, and you shouldn't be able to do that.
And Beth, what do you expect on the prosecution's rebuttal?
Well, the rebuttal is going to consist of a psychologist to rebut the two psychologists the defense have called. And, you know, these psychologists can testify. They can interview witnesses and testify to what the witnesses would say if called. You know, and I know experts can do that anyway in guilt phases, but it seems that they can – it seems a little broader in this penalty phase. So they're going to call this psychologist we saw at the first trial, Janine DeMarte. And then they may call some civilians, I'm not sure, perhaps a former girlfriend of Travis Alexander. I don't know that their case will be all that long, maybe a couple of weeks. But the prosecution will move faster. You know, they kind of line up their witnesses and they fill the days. The defense has had a lot of issues. You know, they've appealed rulings, and the whole issue with Jodi Arias taking the stand has caused their case to slow right now and come to a halt at times. But I don't think that will happen with the state.
So getting off topic just slightly, did you have a chance, Beth, to catch the President's State of the Union last night?
I saw your question, and I don't. I was being interviewed by the Daily Beast, and so I did not. I've had it on, but it was on mute, so I can't answer your question. What did he not say? What's the answer?
I'm not going to give it up. You're going to have to stay tuned, Beth. He actually said something very – he said that he wanted to reform the criminal justice system, but he really didn't give any detail. So I don't know if you had caught that, but I thought he gave a powerful, feisty speech, and we'll talk about that in our answer to the question of the day. Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. Thank you, as always, for joining us. I hope
My
that
pleasure.
They make some progress in that trial, and we will speak soon.
Okay, talk to you next week. Take care.
Thanks, Beth. Bye-bye. Okay, now the question of the day. What did President Obama not say in last night's State of the Union? Answer, President Obama did not utter the phrase fundamentalist Islamic terrorism. He indicated that we are basically finished with the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Our troop levels are dramatically decreased. I believe we only have about 15,000 troops left in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. But he will not, for whatever reason, utter the phrase fundamentalist Islamic terrorism. He talks about terrorism, but he will not admit that ISIS, the Islamic State in Iran and Syria, is a fundamentalist Islamic group, and that Al-Qaeda is also a fundamentalist Islamic group, which, along with Boko Haram in Nigeria, Hamas and Hezbollah and others, are wreaking havoc throughout the world, in France, in Israel, in the United States, unfortunately, at times. And I fear that until this president comes to terms with the threat posed by this terrible fundamentalist Islamic terrorism problem we have, that we are not going to make headway against what he refers to as ISIL, which, contrary to what he said in the State of the Union, I believe is gaining power and ground over there. And this problem is not over, and things are not as peachy as the president wanted to let on last night. The other thing he didn't say, which we discussed with Beth very briefly, is President Obama said he proposes to reform the criminal justice system. What he didn't say was how he intends to do that, what proposals he will set forth to enact that reform. I would like to hear what these proposals are. Are we going to get sentencing reform? Are we going to get reforms in terms of videotaped interrogations, mechanisms to prevent wrongful convictions? We didn't hear anything about that. Now, what did President Obama say? He actually overall made a very good speech, as I said earlier. I thought he came across great. I thought he framed the debate and took control of the national conversation. He said he was going to tax upper-income Americans and corporations to pay for free community college and to pay $3,000 for each middle-class family for child care. He talked about a number of items he would veto if they came to his desk, including vetoing additional sanctions against Iran, which he is against. He says he wants Congress to enact a resolution to authorize him to use force against ISIL, which I thought was curious because I thought that we were already attacking ISIL. At least I hope we are. The president also urged the Congress to end the Cuban embargo now because it's a failed policy which has not worked for the past 50 years. And the president said we should go to war as a last resort and use diplomacy to build coalitions to make headway in the world. I want to thank Bob Ney, former congressman, for coming on the show. Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. Next week, we will be joined by former United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. We provide you with all the updates on the show on facebook.com/talkinlaw. Email me. I want to hear from our listeners, talkinlaw@gmail.com. If you have suggestions for guests, if you want to sponsor the show, if you have ideas for how to improve the show, if you want to tell me that the show stinks, whatever. I want to hear from you. Email the show, talkinlaw@gmail.com. I want to wish everybody a good week and peace and justice. See you next week, Wednesday, 9:30 a.m. with former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.